This week on Family Anatomy, anatomy of three things.
The hosts of Family Anatomy are psychologists, but they're not your psychologists. So if you want to talk to someone about family or mental health issues, you can get a referral from your family doctor. This show is for information only.
Welcome to Family Anatomy, your source for parenting and relationship information with your hosts, Dr. Giuseppe Spizzano
and Dr. Brian McDonald. And it's the end of the month, and the end of the month at Family Anatomy means we're going to be talking about three relatively recent, I think, stories about, well, they have to do with parenting or mental health or relationships, things like that.
Yeah, two of them are from 2009 and the third is from 2006. So
fairly recent, yeah. But things that we thought were kind of interesting. And in fact, one of them is a story that, Giuseppe, you've had people asking you about, is there any research on this topic, right? One of the ones I'm bringing to the table tonight is about people with young adults, so people who are away at college with weight problems, and whether or not how they react to spam emails that you get.
That's right. And another one is going to be about, like Brian was saying, that people have been telling me or asking me, some of them telling me actually, when you're born during the year really affects how you do at school and intelligence and stuff like that.
And the third story that we're bringing tonight is one about loneliness. And it's a really, I think, anyway, it's a really interesting study that looked at how loneliness is contagious in a social group.
And in a small town, they had this really interesting group of people they looked at.
Don't give it all away. All right. So first story of the night, weight problems and spam. And this is something from a journal that I'd never heard of until this afternoon, Southern Medical Journal. And it's in the recent issue of Southern Medical Journal. You know what they said? This is a 2009 study. They said in the group of people they surveyed, over 80% of them received spam emails. What do you think about that?
That's a lot.
But you know, I think that's an underestimate.
Yeah, I mean, it depends. Like, I have several email addresses. One of them gets spam several times a day.
Wow, several times a day.
Yeah.
My God. You know, we know, both of us have published articles in journals, and what happens is, you know, you collect your data. It takes you a certain number of months to write the paper and to edit it. You submit it to a journal. They send it back for changes. You finally submit it and it's accepted. And then it might be published months down the road, right? So these data might be, I don't have the specifics.
It could take a year and a half.
It could take a year or even a couple of years before, you know, in between the time that you collect the data and the time that the study comes out. So they might have been looking in 2007 and there might be more spam now in 2010 than there was back then. But certainly I get a ton of it. Over 80% of people in that study, and they were looking at college students, like we said at the beginning. So they were at the beginning of the study, they looked at,
there was 200 people,
They were looking at whether they were looking at weight problems. They were looking at their self-esteem and they were looking at their level of stress.
So they were looking at specifically weight problems and getting spam email about, you know, how to solve your weight problem or products related to your health and trying to solve that.
Right. You know, are these people more likely to take advantage of those offers that you get in your spam email? Now,
well,
do you think all of our listeners know what spam is when we talk about spam email?
Maybe we should explain that.
Okay. So a spam email is it's like junk mail that you get in your regular mailbox. It's something that's unsolicited and somehow someone has managed to get their hands on your email address and they're sending you advertisements for things that they hope that you'll order in the mail.
That's right. So what they were looking at here was whether people with weight problems get get more of this mail, whether they open more of it when they do get it, and whether they purchase the things that they're sent in the spam email.
Exactly. And one of the things that they found out was that, well, whoever these spammers are, they're fairly good at targeting.
They are.
People who had weight problems were more likely to get spam about weight loss programs.
Right. So somehow the people who have weight issues, somehow they maybe because they're more likely to have ordered something with regards to weight loss products once, that email address got out there, was sold to a bunch of others, and now they're getting the spam email.
This was kind of interesting. I thought, oh, okay, well, it works. But guess what? If you look at the next little section of the study, more than 70% of all the recipients received weight loss email anyway. So it wasn't just the people who were overweight. Although they were more likely to get it, everybody was. It was pretty much they were blanketing everybody just to in the hopes that somebody would buy their program.
Saturation.
Exactly right. Well, so what did they find out? Were the people who were overweight more likely to open those emails?
They were more likely to open the emails. They're more likely to buy the products. And if there's some perceived stress in their life, they're also more likely to buy more.
So people who were stressed were buying more. People with weight problems were more likely to check out those emails.
It was not the one thing that they didn't find, though. It was not related to low self-esteem. So, if, you know, people with low self-esteem were not more likely to be inundated with these kinds of emails or to open them or to buy more.
Right. So, but I mean, what are we learning from this is that in some ways, I mean, spam works. It's finding its audience. The audience is more likely, at least when it comes to weight loss, they're more likely to open and buy from the people that are sending that stuff out.
And the other thing I think is important that comes out of this is because we know most of these weight loss products don't work.
Well, particularly the companies that are selling them through unsolicited email.
Right. So because they don't work, but these people who have these issues are being targeted, they're being exploited.
Absolutely. And this is a study that was looking at young university students. These are people who maybe it's their first time away from home. Maybe it's their first time having unsupervised internet access. Maybe it's their first time having a credit card that they can use to purchase this online stuff, right?
Right.
You put those things together and all of a sudden you've got an audience for these unsolicited emails. And then add to that the stress. If you're on your own for the first time, if you're at university,
stressful.
There's exams and things, this is stressful.
Yeah. It's so a bad mix.
It is a bad mix. And it's something that maybe, do you think your parents would be aware of something like this? My parents wouldn't be. I mean, I know about spam because I have email accounts that I get tons of spam. But would I sit down with my son before he goes off to university and talk about what that's all about and why you should or shouldn't purchase
that
stuff?
Part of the surprising part of this is that, you know, I assume whenever I see spam email, it's usually on my iPhone, and it's annoying because I can see it right away, and I have to click on it to get rid of it. But I don't read it, so I assume that it's useless.
Exactly.
But really, what this is saying is that they're targeting an audience, and to some extent, they're being successful.
Right. And I mean, some of those emails can be misleading, right? Like, you might get an email that looks like it's a response to something that you sent out. I've gotten spam that's like, regarding your message sort of thing. Like, did I send a message to somebody? That it looks like a real message from somebody, and then I open it up, and it's for a weight loss program. Wait, that's not what... I know that's not in response to anything I sent out. For me, it highlights the importance of educating yourself as a parent, but educating your kids before they go away from home, what these things are all about. And even the companies that are just putting this unsolicited stuff out there as junk mail, that they're not pulling any kind of a scam to steal your credit card numbers or anything like that, but we know that there are those kinds of scams that show up in your junk mail box also. But even for those legitimate companies that just happen to be marketing their product that way, this is something that kids need to know about and be wary of.
when you're purchasing something on the net and you're putting your email address out there, it can be sold off. I mean, that's a number one important thing to remember.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So that's the first story of the night. What are you bringing to the table?
Well, a 2009 study called Alone in the Crowd, the Structure and Spread of Loneliness in a Large Social Network. The researchers here, James Fowler, Nicholas Christakis, and a very easy name for me to pronounce, John Capocho.
Wow, that's pretty good.
That's why I handled this one.
I like your pronunciation on that.
Yeah, now, a 38-year study.
This is really, I just, when I read about this, I thought it was so cool. That was the part. It was more than the results or anything else, right? They had almost the entire population of a town filling out their questionnaires and being medically examined every 2 years from 1948 on. And people who would move away from this town would come back to town for
they
to fill out the surveys.
Nobody.
They lost nobody.
They didn't lose any subjects. This is almost unheard of. So really. I've never heard of that before.
In 1948, for every 2 years, they examined these people. In 1971, they added their kids to the study, and the kids didn't drop out. And they were examining the kids every 4 years, and then there were some other additions over time. So they had various groups, but this study looked at data that was collected from those first two groups between 1971 and 2007. That just blew my mind when I read it. And what was kind of funny about this, though, is that I read about that and I thought, this sounds familiar. Where have I heard about this before? This group was a sample that was being collected for a different study. Actually, they were looking at heart attack risk or something, things like it was more of a cardiovascular study originally, but they included all of these other measures. And a year ago, I wrote on the website a story about how happiness is contagious across social networks. And I went back and I searched, you know, because I have that terrible memory, and I went back and I searched Family Anatomy. I found that story. I think it was called Happiness is a Disease. Well, guess what? It's by Fowler and Christakis, the right. same authors
it's,
of this
so it's
study.
The other side of the coin.
Using the same sample, but now that this time around, they're looking at loneliness instead of happiness.
Loneliness as a disease is part, you know, in quotations, is part of what's happening here. Because you think about loneliness as something objective, but really they say that's an endpoint. And what you start with is a perceived sense of loneliness, and you could be in a crowd. Part of how loneliness spreads is not the environment, it's contagious. Lonely people seek out other people, and by seeking them out, non-lonely people become lonely through that intimate contact of talking to a lonely person.
And it's something that maybe you wouldn't have thought of before, but there's a body of research that shows that how lonely you feel may be very discrepant from the number of people who are in your social group. So you could be in a big group of people and still feel lonely. There's even some studies that show that the tendency to feel lonely can be at least partially inherited.
Right. And now the other thing that they were talking about is that spread of loneliness is to 3 degrees.
Yeah, that was something that I thought was pretty interesting. There were two different ideas for I think, what might happen in terms of why lonely people tend to cluster together. Is it that there's a lonely person and he makes other people feel bad around him? Or is it that when you're feeling lonely, you seek out other people who are like you because, you know, people who are similar
to validate
tend to attract
feeling,
one another.
Sure.
You seek out other people who are like you, and so you wind up with this little lonely group. But what they found out is that that wasn't the case. It wasn't that you were looking for someone who was already lonely.
I mean, what they found out also is that how do people guard against this? Because it's a phenomenon. A lonely person can make you as an individual who's not lonely, lonelier.
In fact,
and
it
you
makes,
can make people around you lonelier, and they can make, like, it's 3 degrees, they can make people around yeah. them lonelier. So
the
how
friends
does that
of your
stop?
Friends.
Because really, you start to think, well, this is endless, right? Yeah. What happens is...
They put it in the study as the friends of your friends' friends will become
friends
lonely
friends,
if you're
friends.
Lonely. So it's your friends will make their friends lonely, and they will make their friends lonely.
There's a party I want to go to.
Wow.
Yeah. So, but what they did, what they're speculating is, because how do you stop this spread, right? It's like a disease phenomena. Mm-hmm. And part of the speculation is, because there's a study by Harlow back, I think it was in the 50s, if I'm remembering correctly, with the rhesus monkeys. And what they did was they shunned the person, the monkey that was coming back from isolation.
They wouldn't let that lonely monkey into the social group.
Back into, in fact, them, I guess, with that loneliness, let's say. So they're speculating that this is also what would happen with humans. And so the person who starts off with perceived loneliness can end up with objective loneliness because they end up being shunned to stop the spread of this bad feeling.
So eventually, if your friend is lonely, eventually you're going to cut that person off. But what they found is that sometimes that happens maybe only after that lonely feeling has spread and you wind up with that 3 degrees. But I guess the shunning is why it stops before it gets beyond that 3 degrees.
Spreads further with women than with men.
One of the reasons why the researchers thought was maybe because women are more likely to disclose their feelings to other women. And so if you're feeling lonely and you're a woman, you're more likely than a man to tell your friends about how you're doing.
Because it comes through face-to-face discussions and disclosures. Almost sounds like, you know, when you're giving someone, I mean, you cough on someone, you know, the same kind of
it is, you know, it's just like, thing. It's loneliness is like a disease in that way, right?
Well, I mean, that's the kind of allegory they're using there. But, you know, and it also happens more in friendship networks than it happens in family networks. To me, the what it sounds like is, it's more like, it's almost reverse of what I would think because, mm-hmm. you know, in friendship networks, you think that it would be easier to cut off a friend than a family member to stop the spread of loneliness, but that's not what the results are showing.
And they said, well, maybe what's been shown in previous studies is that older people tend to trim their social networks to focus on the relationships that are most validating for them, and
they tend to
cut family members right. off if they're not getting along, maybe with those family members. So
they've had enough. So enough, I tell you.
And it turns out that in this group, in this sample, it tended to be a group of older adults. So maybe they were quicker to cut off their lonely family members than they would be to cut off their lonely friends. And so it was spreading more slowly because they threw those family members out of their social group.
That's it.
Wow. So a 38-year study, that's a lot of information.
That's a lot of information.
If you look at the original article, you see graphs of the social network. It's pretty incredible, the work that they did.
It's incredible that they were able to really thoroughly study all the members of this small town for such a long time. It's almost unreal.
Maybe this town will become a tourist attraction now.
Yes.
Now that everybody knows about how lonely everyone there is.
That's right.
Let's go visit them. We'll
help them
feel better.
Yes.
All right, the third story of the night was, and this is the one that you've been asked about by your friends and coworkers. Does it matter what month you're born in? Is that going to affect your intelligence or your performance at school later on?
Now, this one's called Season of Birth and Childhood Intelligence, findings from the Aberdeen Children of the 1950s cohort study. So the researchers, Debbie Lawler, Heather Clark, Georgia Ronalds, I think that is David Leon.
I just wrote Lawler and colleagues on my
University of Bristol in the UK.
Yeah, this is the British Journal of Educational Psychology.
And so this is really old data. This is data from people born between 1950 and 1956 that they analyzed recently in 2006.
Mm-hmm.
And so they looked at three ages of these people at 7 years old, 9 years old, and 11 years old. And what they wanted to find out was there's about six decades of research that shows that kids who are born earlier in the year do better with achievement in school in terms of reading, writing, and math, and with intelligence than kids who are born later in the year, say between September and December.
There's lots of studies that show that. I mean, there are a few, and they mentioned this in the article, there are a few that showed results that were a little bit different. They found a group of adults And they find that as adults, those people who were born earlier in the year versus later, there wasn't a great deal of difference between them. And there was one study that suggested that it was that difference occurs in kids who maybe could be described as slower learners. So kids who would be scoring lower on the IQ to begin with, it's that group where the month in which you were born made more of a difference. But they talked about a couple of theories for why that might be. Why are people born in the winter more likely to score higher on these tests than people who are born in the fall?
And this is what they wanted to try and distinguish in this study. So there's two main theories. Again, you know, with those couple of exceptions that you mentioned, outside of those, it's a pretty clear result over six decades of research showing that there's a difference in achievement and IQ. So,
indeed, yeah.
They're going to look at that again with this data set, which apparently, well, according to them, is much bigger.
They had over 12,000 kids in this study.
Much bigger than a lot of the other studies that are showing this link. And the two main theories for why this happens is that, you know, one is that the kids, because of the way the school year is set up and when you start, if your birthday's in January, and another child's birthday is in December, you could be in the same class and you'd have almost a full year difference in terms of age.
Right. Those kids who are born in January would be starting school later. The kids born in December start school at a younger age, right? Because it's based
on...
Isn't that right?
That's right. So they'd be the youngest in that class.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, the December kids would be the youngest
January
in the class.
January kids would be the oldest in the class. Especially when you're younger, it makes a big difference. I mean, mm-hmm. I can see it with my own kids. Just that in the born in the same year as my neighbor's kid, and you know, a whole head size bigger as my neighbor's kid.
Oh, so, yeah. Yeah, so it makes at a big young difference. Age, young. At that young age, months make a big difference. Yeah.
So there's that idea that, you know, you can have a whole year difference in the same class.
Right. So you might start school younger. You might be a lot younger than your classmates. And maybe that's why there's different scores on IQ tests.
Right. And the second possibility
is, and this is something that we both kind of looked at each other cross-eyed about, the idea that environmental factors might create these differences. That it's not so much the age at which the kids are starting school, but it's
pregnancy.
During the mother's pregnancy, the environmental temperature, the nutrition, the moms might be eating different foods in different seasons, so that might create a difference. And then they talked about the risk of
infection during childbirth.
Perinatal infection. So those are three factors that might result in later learning differences. So these guys wanted to do sort of a longitudinal study and find out, hey, what's really going on here?
Right. So there's the two hypotheses. It comes in the wake of all this research showing that there's an effect. And what do they find?
Tiny, tiny, tiny differences.
Tiny, almost negligible.
In achievement and not IQ, in fact. So there were reading differences, there were math differences. And these were differences where, if you're talking about average kids, I mean, it might be the answer to one or two questions on the IQ test. That's the difference you're talking about.
Right, and that's not an IQ test. Again, it's... Now, here's the other interesting thing.
It's the achievement test, not the IQ test.
And people need to be clear about what we're talking about. Achievement means reading, writing, and math, not IQ. So, and what they found was kids born between February and April, so the earlier born kids, were better at reading at age 9,
mm-hmm.
but not at age 11. I mean, it gets really that
specific. The other kids caught up, right?
Right. So, and then the second thing they found was that kids born between February and April were better at math at 11 years old, but we don't know if they were better at 13 or 15 or 17. So,
and
really,
I mean, we can assume based on that other study about the adult intelligence that probably by the time they get out of school, these kids are all pretty much on par with one another.
This is it. Now, so what they found was there was no relationship to verbal comprehension, which is more of an intelligence measure.
Yeah.
And that it was only something that showed up with reading and math for only those ages, and that it was a very small result.
There was one,
they call it a weak result.
And there was one more thing, though.
Yeah.
This was a very weak result that disappeared once they factored in age of school entry and relative age compared to the rest of your classmates. So the differences didn't really exist anymore. It was any differences that were there were much more about how old you were when you entered school. And it seems like over time that these things, I mean, I would interpret that these things, these very small differences even disappear.
Right. Now, it's a 2006 study. It's probably the most prominent study to date in terms of being up to date.
And we looked, you know what? We after seeing this and they had cited some studies that were older, you know, you and I both, we sat down on Google and Wikipedia and said, okay, well, let's see. What are people saying about this? And you know what people are saying? The results of this 2006 study. I mean, that took up the whole entire first, almost the entire first page of Google, where people talking about this particular result. And, you know, we didn't go into each page because we'd read the original paper. I don't know how they're interpreting it, but my interpretation is parents don't need to worry about what month their kids are born. It doesn't really make any big difference.
That's it. Now, it is flying in the face of all those decades of research, and it is only one study, but it's a pretty solid study. It looked at quite a large group of people. And
as a person with a January birthday, I think that probably, you know, these results are incorrect, and actually I'm smarter than other people who are born later in the year.
And as a person with a December 31st birthday, I realize I'm smarter than most people in the room, so
what?
It's obviously what?
You're also 12 years older, but hey.
Oh.
Whoa. What happened there? Well, that's our three stories.
That's
wow.
It.
That went fast. Did it ever go fast, right? Well, and I guess that's going to bring us to the website of the week.
Let's do it.
And the website of the week this week is www.scientificamerican.com/psychology. I don't think you actually have to type the www part, but there you go.
I like the way you say that, though.
You like that?
Very Texan.
I'm trying. It's Scientific American.
It's because you work with a Texan-born psychologist. I
do work with a psychologist from Texas. Imagine that. But this is the psychology page, the online version of Scientific American magazine. This has a ton of information. Now, it's not just focused on kids and families and couples like Family Anatomy is.
That's right, but it's got a lot. You're right, a lot of information. I mean, if you just had the magazine, you would have just the one or two articles, I suppose. But here online, you've got just a ton of different interesting articles.
Free access to a lot of the material that you find in Scientific American magazine. Now, I guess another difference between Scientific American and Family Anatomy is that a lot of what we write are the clinical implications and the practical implications, and these guys are more just summarizing their research, right? But, I mean, this is interesting. Look at the as we're recording, we're looking at the headlines right now, and the first headline that jumps out is a device that curbs speed eating could help obese children and adolescents.
I don't know about you. The one that sticks out for me is when fear makes us superhuman.
See that?
That's a good one.
This is interesting stuff. So,
a happy couple, secrets to a long marriage. There's lots of good articles on here.
Lots of good. And in fact, Scientific American is one of the places that we look when we're looking for information about articles we want to write about on the website or talk about on the show.
That's right.
So that's our website of the week, scientificamerican.com/psychology.
And that's it for us. You can visit us at familyanatomy.com or email us at info@familyanatomy.com. And we'd again like to thank everyone for getting the word out about the show. And Dr. Brian, as always, has an announcement.
Speaking of getting the word out about the show, it's the end of the month. At the beginning of next month, Podcast Alley is going to reset their votes. Everything's going to go back to zero. We have really appreciated the help of all of the people who are listening right now, who've gone to podcastalley.com and sent a vote to Family Anatomy, because that helps more people to see the podcast and it helps to grow the audience of the show. So that's been really helpful. So if you do like the show, pop by Podcast Alley, search Family Anatomy, click on vote, you enter your email address, you click on a link that goes to your email, and you're done. And it does really help out the show, and we really do appreciate it. And that's our show for tonight. So as usual, we're going to leave you with a bit of a tune by Brother Love, who's over at brotherloverocks.com.
Thanks for listening. It's a family thing. Hey! You know what to do. FamilyAnatomy.com